This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
In March 1936, Hitler's troops moved on Western Germany. World War II was about to arrive in 19-year-old Dorothea Buck's backyard, and she simply couldn't handle the prospect.
Dorothea was so overwhelmed by fear and paranoia that she began to experience periods of psychosis. Her father, a German pastor, decided to have his daughter hospitalized.
Within a few days of being admitted to the Bethel Psychiatric Center in Bielefeld, Germany, Dorothea received her diagnosis. It was far worse than a case of anxiety. Dorothea had schizophrenia.
Over the next 9 months, her treatments included 23-hour baths in a canvas tub, her head restrained, unable to move. Dorothea received injections of paraldehyde, a sense-dulling sedative. She slept in soaked sheets, and her simple requests for things like water went ignored. This wasn't treatment, it was torture.
During her stay, Dorothea noticed that the other female patients had scars on their lower abdomens. Doctors claimed they were from appendectomies, so when Dorothea awoke from her drug-induced stupor one afternoon, she wasn't surprised to notice that she, too, bore the scar.
It wasn't until years later that Dorothea realized her appendix was never removed. Instead, she'd fallen prey to the law for the prevention of offspring with hereditary diseases. Because of Dorothea's schizophrenia diagnosis, her body had been mutilated and sterilized, meaning Dorothea could never bear a child, all in an effort to eliminate mental health conditions from the human race.
When our bodies fail, we trust doctors to diagnose the problem. But medicine isn't always an exact science. Sometimes it's a guessing game with life or death stakes.
This is Medical Mysteries, a Parcast original. I'm Molly.
And I'm Richard. Every Tuesday, we'll look at the strangest real-life medical cases in history and the experts who raced against the clock to solve them.
As we follow these high-intensity stories, we'll explore medical research that might solve the puzzle.
You can find episodes of Medical Mysteries and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Medical Mysteries for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Medical Mysteries in the search bar.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
This is our third of four episodes on mental health. Over 4 weeks, we're exploring the evolution of mental health care from ancient Greece to the modern day. We'll document how humanity's understanding of the mind has changed, how diagnosis and treatment evolved, and how social stigma influenced the way we perceive mental health as a whole, and why it's been such a mystery to treat.
This week, we'll be discussing the medical breakthroughs at the turn of the 20th century. We'll see how one game-changing disorder was first separated from other mental health conditions. But we'll also examine how new, unregulated treatments were performed in a trial-and-error method, which resulted in hundreds of unwarranted deaths. Finally, we'll see how the stigma surrounding mental health conditions evolved as many became targets in a dangerous effort to better the human race.
Hallucinations, paranoia, incoherent speech. For centuries, these were thought to be signs, messages from gods, demons, witches, maybe even the devil himself.
Millions suffered the consequences of this ignorance. Many believed they were making contact with another plane of existence. They had no idea that they were actually living with an emotional disorder, one that went unidentified and unnamed for thousands of years.
The first documentation of the condition dates back to the 2nd millennium BCE in Egypt. An ancient medical text known as the Ebers Papyrus lists more than 842 remedies for a wide variety of ailments. One chapter describes a patient with symptoms like dementia, depression, and other thought disturbances.
The Egyptians believed that all mental health conditions were part of one blanket disorder. It was caused by a combination of blocked communication between the body and mind, angry gods, and demonic spirits.
Then, in 1563, Dutch physician Johan Weyer wrote The Deception of Demons. Despite its misleading title, the book completely rebutted the connection between mental health and witchcraft.
Weyer openly stated that witch burning was godlessness and criticized doctors for endorsing it. Instead, he suggested that mental health conditions stemmed from natural causes, which, ironically, stigmatized Weyer as outlandish and irrational. The church condemned Weyer's book and then accused him of sorcery instead.
In 1809, French physician Philippe Pinel published a text linking all mental health conditions with social stressors that affected a person's psyche. He contested the outdated and aggressive treatments doctors used, including ice water baths, bloodletting, and physical abuse, all of which happened to patients like Hannah Mills and Reverend John Shorey, whose experiences we covered in depth last week. And unfortunately, instead of curing them, the experimental treatments likely led to their deaths. Pinel, however, offered up a more empathetic approach.
He suggested treating a patient with sympathy, kindness, and respect. The objective was to build trust between the patient and the doctor. He also believed in a healthy routine of regular work and activity, hopefully in a cleaner, more humane environment.
Finally, in 1887, German psychiatrist Dr. Emil Kraepelin made an unprecedented discovery. He saw that many of his patients had symptoms like mood swings, feelings of superiority or grandiosity, impulsivity, or periods of depression that were unique to other conditions.
In the past, his colleagues treated all of these patients like they had the same condition. And oftentimes, doctors weren't even looking for symptoms at all, let alone how they correspond to each disorder. This was the case for Michigan resident Lydia Smith, who we covered last week. Lydia was taken by her husband and sister-in-law to an asylum without ever experiencing any symptoms. But in the mid-1800s, it was easy for anyone to check a patient into a hospital and simply claim they were suffering from a condition, just to get rid of them. Mental health was so misunderstood, diagnoses were based on hearsay, and even those without conditions suffered from its mysterious nature.
Dr. Kraepelin realized how dangerous this was when he saw different individuals developing different symptoms. This recognition was the key to understanding the cause and treating them. For example, while some of his patients grew progressively worse over time, others went through cycles of recovery and decline. These patients had similar-looking but completely distinct conditions.
For example, Kraepelin thought that manic depressive illness was a mood disorder that featured periods of remission. Patients with manic depressive illness had a good chance of recovery.
Kraepelin believed manic depressive illness was the result of exogenous or environmental factors. Theoretically, It could be treated if the patient's surroundings changed.
But the other mysterious condition he studied was endogenous, meaning he believed it had an internal cause. It was incurable and grew progressively worse over time. Kraepelin named the strange new condition dementia praecox, meaning early dementia.
Kraepelin speculated that dementia praecox was a neurodegenerative disease. This meant that the building blocks of the nervous system, or neurons, were being destroyed. When this happens, the body can't rebuild or replace them, leading to irreversible damage in the brain.
But Kraepelin didn't know what was causing the destruction of those blocks, and he never found evidence to support this theory. As a result, the cause behind dementia praecox remained a huge mystery.
But in Austria, Sigmund Freud, a respected neurologist, built on Kraepelin's work. Freud, whom we touched on in last week's episode, had a keen interest in neurosis etiology, or the study of how a disorder is caused. And since Kraepelin didn't have a concrete answer, Freud devised his own theories.
He agreed with Kraepelin's decision to separate dementia praecox from other mental health conditions, but Freud believed the condition was an attachment disorder.
Essentially, Freud theorized that childhood experiences are crucial in determining an adult's personality. He was convinced that dementia praecox developed when a child didn't form a sufficient emotional connection to the opposite sex parent.
His work later spawned the idea that maternal overbearance, or the opposite, maternal rejection, could lead a child to distrust and resent other people. Basically, if a mother was either too involved or too disconnected in her child's life, they would grow up to have dementia praecox.
But like Kraepelin, Freud's theories were nothing more than speculation based on his own prior assumptions. His theories about maternal overbearance or rejection were later debunked by psychiatrists who felt Freud put more emphasis on blame than on scientific fact.
While many doctors were working to either prove or debunk Freud's theories, Swiss psychiatrist Eugene Bleuler was trying to update Kraepelin's work on dementia praecox. At a world lecture in Berlin in 1908, he presented his research and announced his new term for the disorder, schizophrenia.
Bleuler felt that Kraepelin's term dementia praecox was misleading because the condition didn't always lead to mental deterioration. Rather, schizophrenia led to a heightened state of emotion. It made patients more in tune with their surroundings.
That might sound like an odd observation, since schizophrenia often includes hallucinations and other distortions of reality. But the situation is more complicated than that. A person with schizophrenia may hear voices or perceive the world in irrational ways, but they're still highly aware of the people, places, sights, and sounds they experience.
Dr. Clara Humpston of the University of Birmingham's Institute for Mental Health explained, "To say that lacking insight is a sign of losing touch with reality is like saying a colorblind person is unable to see anything at all. Schizophrenia is like color blindness in this way. It taints and distorts everything one sees, but does not cause one to lose eyesight altogether."
In addition to recognizing this distinction, Bleuler also had a theory about schizophrenia's cause. He married the philosophies of Freud and Kraepelin. In other words, Bleuler believed nature and nurture both played a role.
But the medical community still had a lot to learn before schizophrenia could be cured or even treated effectively. After all, Bleuler's theory was just a theory, and there was no concrete evidence to prove that these factors caused the disorder.
Which was why, for the first few decades of the 1900s, there were no effective medical treatments for patients with schizophrenia. The treatments that did exist felt barbaric and extremely antiquated, even for the time.
Thousands of patients were institutionalized because the disorder was seen as incurable and hopeless. A fear of the unknown permeated society. Many believed the condition could strike anyone at any time, People feared they might be the next to get diagnosed.
Luckily, the early 20th century brought a surge in experimental treatments that offered hope for the future. Unfortunately, these untested remedies sometimes also led to death. Coming up, we'll explore insulin and electroshock therapies.
Now, back to the story.
In 1887, German psychiatrist Dr. Emil Kraepelin unlocked a mystery that had baffled doctors for centuries. He realized that dementia praecox was its own unique condition and should be treated as such. Then, in 1908, Swiss psychiatrist Eugene Bleuler recognized that the term dementia didn't exactly fit the diagnosis. He retitled the disorder schizophrenia.
No one could pinpoint exactly what caused it, but that didn't stop scientists from experimenting with new ways to treat and cure the condition.
In the early 1900s, American surgeon Bayard Holmes was all too familiar with schizophrenia. His own teenage son had developed the disorder, and Holmes refused to accept that it was incurable. Schizophrenia was still a rather new classification, and treatments for that specific disorder, rather than the previous one-size-fits-all mental health approach, were still in their infancy. So Holmes devoted his career to finding the cure.
He'd never believed in psychology and regarded the field with contempt. Instead, Holmes searched for a biological cause for his son's disorder.
He theorized that fecal matter in the colon or small intestine caused bacteria to grow in that region. Large masses of bacteria produced toxic alkaloids, poisons that Holmes believed were associated with psychotic symptoms. They also supposedly affected brain functionality, creating mental health conditions. Holmes believed he could clear these toxins by draining or removing the damaged organ, which would then cure schizophrenia.
Holmes decided to test this theory on his very own son. After all, it was the only way to spare him the horrors of asylums. He began by cutting a small opening in the intestine where he believed the bacteria originated. He then irrigated the organ, flushing it out with water daily to stop the toxic bacterial growth.
But only 4 days into the experiment, his son's health began to spiral. A surgical complication made the boy take a turn for the worse. Soon, Holmes' son began to fade. Hours later, the boy died.
Holmes was devastated, but he still believed that he was on the right track. He operated on 22 more patients with schizophrenia between 1916 and 1919. He reported 2 fatalities and claimed that the rest were a success. But his definition of success was never explained, and it's unlikely his patients would have shared his sentiments. Ultimately, there was no proven connection between toxic bacteria and mental health conditions. Holmes' theory was nothing more than a stab in the dark.
But his contemporaries seemed to think otherwise. Holmes' work inspired a generation of doctors, like Dr. Henry Cotton at the New Jersey State Hospital in Trenton. Cotton had spent years learning from Dr. Emil Kraepelin, and he believed that Holmes had made a brilliant discovery with his bacteria theory.
Only Cotton didn't think toxicities came from the intestine. Instead, he believed they came from the subject's teeth or tonsils in the form of contaminated saliva. He theorized that patients infected by tooth decay swallowed this saliva, which then transferred toxins to the brain and the rest of the body.
So he began extracting the teeth and tonsils. But when that didn't produce results, he pivoted. He removed gallbladders, colons, thyroids, anywhere that he believed infection might linger. Over 30% of Cotton's patients died from the procedures, which he blamed on their poor physical condition.
But the real cause might have been peritonitis. This is an inflammation of the abdominal membrane, sometimes caused by bacteria, the rupture of an organ, or an improperly sterilized surgery. Ironically, Cotton may have killed his patients with one infection in an effort to cure another.
Cotton's high death rate stirred up a lot of controversy. People felt that his and Holmes' methods were unjustified and inhumane. Cotton, in turn, blamed his inadequacies on his predominantly male staff, then hired all female nurses instead.
As a New York Times piece explained, men are naturally too rough with the patients. Cotton believes the presence of women nurses is restful to the diseased mind.
In spite of the new, all-female staff, Cotton and Holmes failed to make any revolutionary breakthroughs.
But more researchers were joining the search for a cure, sometimes by accident. In 1927, German neurophysiologist Manfred J. Seckel discovered a way to artificially induce a coma by injecting a patient with insulin.
Insulin had only been discovered recently, in the early 1920s. This hormone, made in the pancreas, helps maintain the balance of glucose or sugar in the body. Seckel was working on ways to treat heroin addicts and had found that insulin injections helped patients stay calm during their withdrawal periods.
One patient was a woman with schizophrenia as well as a heroin addiction. One afternoon, while administering her dosage, Seckel gave the patient a little too much. The woman began convulsing, then fell into a coma.
Luckily, Seckel caught it early and woke the patient with a glucose injection. When she opened her eyes, she found that she'd regained her mental faculties. While the exact changes are unclear, based on further experiments, the patient likely regained her memories and other forms of awareness that had been lost during the addiction. Inspired, Seckel began intentionally sending people with mental health conditions into insulin comas. When they woke, their symptoms were often in remission.
Seckel didn't understand how the procedure, which he dubbed insulin shock therapy, worked. What mattered was that it seemed to be effective, especially for people with mental health conditions like schizophrenia. Insulin shock therapy spread throughout the medical community.
But the process was tedious for patients who went through it 3 to 5 times a week, sometimes requiring up to 50 treatments total. And while the therapy temporarily muted their symptoms, it didn't offer long-term results. Instead, it caused side effects like amnesia, obesity, severe brain damage, or irreversible comas that led to death.
In 1934, Portuguese psychiatrist Ladislas Joseph Meduna built on Seckel's limited success with insulin shock therapy. He discovered that large doses of a stimulant known as metrazol, could also give a patient seizures. Like insulin comas, these also decreased symptoms in the short term. Meduna's treatment became known as convulsion therapy.
In 1937, Italian neurologist Ugo Carletti decided that convulsion therapy was far too dangerous and uncontrollable, but he had a better alternative.
He'd seen pigs receive an electric shock before going to a butcher, and he'd noted the way the shock seemed to anesthetize the stressed-out animals. Based on these observations, he convinced his colleagues that electroconvulsive shock therapy, or ECT, was a safer option for treating mental health conditions. ECT works by applying electrodes to a patient's scalp and sending an electric current directly into the brain to produce a seizure.
Like other kinds of shock therapy, ECT was a short-term treatment that came with unpleasant side effects. Many patients experienced confusion, memory loss, nausea, headaches, and increased blood pressure. These side effects made the treatment highly controversial, but it was still temporarily effective, which is why ECT is still used today.
But that didn't stop doctors from testing new methods. In the late 1930s, psychiatrist Walter Jackson Freeman II sought a new way to treat mental health conditions without the unpleasant side effects of shock therapy. He theorized that an abundance of strong emotion led to emotional disorders. So, if he could get rid of a person's feelings, he could also cure their ailments. He believed he could do that by severing nerve connections in a patient's brain.
Freeman tested this procedure, called a lobotomy, on cadavers. He inserted an ice pick through their eyes and then shifted it side to side to separate the thalamus, the sensory and pain receptor in the brain, from the frontal lobe.
Before the end of the decade, he switched to a tool called an orbitoclast and began operating on real patients.
Unfortunately, his remedy had some side effects. Lobotomies destroyed brain tissue, making patients lose memories, inhibitions, and empathy, and sometimes their entire personalities. The process could even leave someone in an irreversible catatonic state. About a third of the lobotomies were considered successful in getting rid of symptoms, but many of those so-called successes came at great cost. Many physicians decided on their patients' behalf that any side effect was preferable to living with a mental health condition.
But at the same time, there was another dangerous mindset starting to spread. If doctors couldn't cure mental health conditions, then perhaps there was a way to stop them from ever happening in the first place. People began to envision a future that didn't include people with mental health conditions at all, or anyone who carried so-called undesirable traits.
Contrary to popular belief, the modern eugenics movement actually began in the United Kingdom before spreading through the world. The word eugenics, which translates to good creation, is the concept of improving the human race through reproduction. The hope was to eradicate undesirable hereditary traits and allow only a select few to procreate.
Supporters of the movement believed that mental health conditions were passed on through genetics. And since Kraepelin had originally painted schizophrenia as a hopeless and deteriorating disorder, people who had it were about to experience horrific consequences.
Connecticut had already made it illegal for people with mental health conditions to marry back in 1896. But Charles Davenport, a respected American eugenicist and biologist, pushed the rest of the country down the same path of discrimination. He founded the Eugenics Record Office in 1910 with the hopes of improving the natural, physical, mental, and temperamental qualities of the human family.
The organization dispatched field workers to collect data from American citizens. They took special interest in anyone with a family history of poverty, criminality, or mental health conditions like schizophrenia.
Meanwhile, eugenicists found ways to keep people with allegedly undesirable traits from procreating. They persuaded their state legislatures to pass a mandatory sterilization law that would leave people unable to reproduce.
Indiana was the first state to pass the law in 1907, followed by Washington, Connecticut, and California in 1909. 29 more states joined them, but California took the lead, sterilizing more people than any other state. 60% had mental health conditions. 35% were considered mentally deficient, meaning they had a developmental disability. The remaining 5% were racial minorities and the poor.
Ironically, but unsurprisingly, far more women were sterilized than men, a double standard.
There was very little pushback against these laws. The eugenics movement offered upper-class, healthy people a way to feel superior, and it was backed by pseudoscience.
It seeped into American culture in a macabre way. Powerful men like John Harvey Kellogg created the Race Betterment Foundation to promote eugenics and encourage people to maintain good pedigrees.
Citizens even competed in eugenics competitions. State fairs hosted Better Baby contests, where competitors between the ages of 6 and 48 months were judged on their health. The competitions aimed to promote routine medical exams for children and maintain excellency in the human race.
Meanwhile, fitter family competitions appealed almost exclusively to white and American-born families, often Protestants who were well-educated. Participants gave blood and urine samples, documented their height and weight, and took personality tests in order to prove they were a model citizen.
And apparently, these gimmicks were extremely influential. They were even enough to influence some of America's most respected decision makers. Because in 1927, Buck versus Bell was brought to the Supreme Court. The case became a turning point in the movement.
A Virginia teenager, Carrie Buck, was committed to a state institution after getting pregnant out of wedlock. She, along with her mother and newborn daughter, faced threats of sterilization on the grounds that they were all feeble-minded.
Once the case reached the Supreme Court, they ultimately ruled 8-1 that it was reasonable and legal for the state to prevent the manifestly unfit from continuing their kind.
In essence, the Supreme Court declared that forced sterilization did not violate the Constitution in any way. In fact, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes went as far as to say, three generations of imbeciles are enough. The ruling remained staunchly in place for the next two decades as thousands more underwent inhumane sterilization procedures all over the country. Though later rulings complicated sterilization's legality, the Buck decision has never been officially overturned.
The movement was spreading in England under the guidance of politician Sir Winston Churchill. Churchill was thought to be a eugenicist. He believed the feeble-minded, as he called them, gave birth to far more babies at a faster pace than those he referred to as superior stock.
Allegedly, one memo from Churchill to Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain read, "The multiplication of the feeble-minded is a very terrible danger to the race."
But he had a solution to this alleged problem, one inspired by the sterilization measures the United States had passed. When he was appointed Home Secretary in Her Majesty's government, Churchill tried to impose the same inhumane laws in England.
He allegedly stood in front of Parliament and argued that people with mental health conditions should be forced into labor camps. His reasoning? They needed to realize their duty to the state.
Luckily, England never followed through on Churchill's advice. But that didn't stop this festering mentality. It had only just begun, and it was creeping into Germany. People with mental health conditions were among those about to become targets in the Nazis' extermination plan.
Coming up, over 100,000 people with schizophrenia fall victim to the Nazis. Now, back to the story.
In the 1920s, the eugenics movement skyrocketed in Britain and the United States and influenced the rest of the world. And it was presented as a so-called cure for mental health conditions. Many patients were forced to undergo procedures like tubal ligation or vasectomies without their consent.
Adolf Hitler took a cue from the American eugenics movement as he rose to power in 1933. He'd just become Chancellor of Germany, and it was no secret that Hitler was anti-Semitic. He saw the Jewish community as an inferior race that threatened Aryan purity. But he also advocated for the genocide of psychiatric patients, who he believed tainted his utopia.
Hitler thought that mental health conditions were hereditary. They were unavoidable and incurable. This idea was supported by Nazi eugenicist and psychiatrist Dr. Ernst Rüden, who had a particular interest in the hereditary nature of schizophrenia. He even said, "People who are themselves mentally ill should not have children."
Rüden worked closely with his protege, Franz Josef Kalman, who found evidence to support the hereditary nature of the disease. He created the twin family method, which studied sets of twins to determine which illnesses were inherited and which were environmental.
The crux of Kalman's work came down to the difference between identical and fraternal twins. At conception, identical twins come from a single egg which splits into two separate embryos with identical DNA. Fraternal twins, by contrast, come from two distinct sets of egg and sperm. Genetically speaking, fraternal twins are no different than any other set of siblings.
Environmentally, however, identical and fraternal twins are special. Because they're born on the same day to the same parents, they'll grow up in the same household, have the same formative experiences at the same time, and meet the same people.
Basically, Kalman could compare and contrast twins' childhoods and adult traits. If identical twins developed the same conditions, but fraternal ones didn't, then those disorders were probably biological. If the opposite were true, since fraternal twins and identical twins all shared commonalities, the condition was probably environmental.
When it came to schizophrenia, Kalman examined the family histories of 1,087 people with the condition. He found a strong correlation between schizophrenia and close familial relationships. In other words, it's possible for, say, an aunt and a nephew to both have schizophrenia, but it's a lot more likely for a parent to pass it to a child, or for two identical twins to each have it, because they share more DNA than more distant relatives.
Due to Kalman's findings, Dr. Rüden became one of the biggest advocates for Germany's first mandatory sterilization bill. It specifically targeted people with manic depressive disorder, epilepsy, hereditary blindness, alcoholism, and of course, schizophrenia.
Psychiatric hospitals were already extremely overcrowded. As a result, many patients were forced out to accommodate people who were perceived as a danger to themselves or the community. Since people with schizophrenia often fell into this category, they were marked as a high priority for sterilization before they could ever be released.
As a result of Kalman's research, even some relatives of patients with schizophrenia were forced into sterilization as a precautionary measure.
And in his first year as chancellor, Hitler worked to escalate these policies. Forced sterilization simply wouldn't suffice. He needed a more permanent solution.
Hitler used the statistics given to him by psychiatrist Berthold Kien to make his point. Kien estimated that people with mental health conditions had cost Germany more than 150 million Reichsmarks per year. So Hitler's supposedly economic solution was to kill off the mental patients flooding the hospitals.
Hitler's plan for a mass genocide wasn't put into action until 7 years later, packaged together with his plans to invade Poland and declare war in 1939. That's when his private physician and other trusted members of the Third Reich drafted a new law.
According to a report by the Stanley Medical Research Institute, this new legislation said, "The life of a person who, because of incurable mental illness, requires permanent institutionalization and is not able to sustain an independent existence, may be prematurely terminated by medical measures in a painless and covert manner."
Some psychiatrists and asylum physicians asked to excuse patients who performed essential services to keep the institutions running. But Professor Friedrich Mautz refused any exemptions for people diagnosed with schizophrenia. He claimed it was a matter of principle.
The program was implemented on September 1, 1939, the same day that Germany invaded Poland, the very first day of World War II.
By October, the staff of every psychiatric hospital in Germany was required to fill out extensive forms on each patient. While many were still unaware of what the Nazis would do with the reports, they were told to list the diagnosis for each individual and assess their ability to perform physical labor. These forms were then evaluated by a committee known, ironically, as the Charitable Foundation for Curative and Institutional Care.
People with schizophrenia were diagnosed by three different doctors. If two out of the three agreed that the person had the disorder, the patient was sent to be executed.
And things only escalated from there. By 1940, people with mental health conditions were filed into the hospital's shower rooms, where doctors released carbon monoxide to kill their own patients.
Afterward, gold fillings were pulled from the victims' teeth in order to fund the program that had just sealed their fate.
The Nazis found the gassing method so successful, they began implementing it in concentration camps.
In some areas of Germany, mental patients were killed by an army firing squad. In East Prussia, patients were loaded into military trucks and gassed. In Pomerania, more than 3,000 people with mental health conditions were killed when Nazis seized an asylum to use as their personal barracks.
And children weren't excused from the brutality either. Over 300 children with mental health conditions were murdered at one hospital in Bavaria between 1940 and 1945. They were either starved or injected with poison, and that was just one location. It's believed between 5 to 10,000 children throughout Nazi Germany were killed under this program.
By this point, Germany was embroiled in an all-out war with the Allied forces. The United States government was looking for any advantage they could turn against the Axis powers.
In 1943, American psychologist Henry Murray was hired by the U.S. Office of Strategic Services. He was brought on to assess Adolf Hitler's personality and predict his next moves. Murray recognized that Hitler exhibited frequent emotional outbursts, accusatory behavior that ended in tears, and self-pity leading to extreme depression.
Murray published a 227-page report on Hitler that described him as a paranoid, utter wreck, incapable of normal human relationships. His final diagnosis was that Hitler was actually a borderline paranoid schizophrenic.
It's highly unlikely that any of Hitler's doctors would have dared diagnose him with a disorder. Even if he was aware he had a mental health condition, it's unlikely he would have had sympathy for other people with them. After all, he took out many of his own insecurities on the people he persecuted.
By the end of the war in 1945, Hitler had sterilized or murdered an estimated 675,000 patients with mental health conditions in Germany alone. Approximately 132,000 people with schizophrenia were sterilized, and up to 137,000 were killed.
And things didn't get better after the war. For example, 19-year-old Dorothea Buck had her life spared, but her diagnosis of schizophrenia and her involuntary sterilization followed her for life.
Buck was unable to pursue a higher degree. She was forced to abandon her career as a kindergarten teacher. She wasn't allowed to marry a partner who hadn't also been sterilized. And in addition to all the stigma and discrimination, she was still battling a chronic condition.
Thankfully, the eugenics movement started to fizzle out after World War II, probably because of the negative connotation it had after Hitler's actions. The sterilization programs in America began to fade out of existence, although they weren't eradicated entirely.
Luckily, they were replaced with progressive efforts to help people with mental health conditions. In 1946, President Harry Truman implemented the National Institute of Mental Health, which helped veterans who experienced conditions like post-traumatic stress disorder. It also provided funding to improve psychiatric research.
Attitudes on mental health were changing. People had more empathy for those living with a disorder. In the 1950s, the National Mental Health Act paved the way for psychopharmacology, or the study of the relationship between medication and mental health.
A naval surgeon named Henri Laborie started testing chlorpromazine on patients with psychotic disorders like schizophrenia. He found that it helped them relax. Rather than completely shutting off the brain, chlorpromazine worked to mute the symptoms. Meanwhile, the person could still think clearly and go about their day-to-day life.
However, it took a while for the medical community to accept these antipsychotic medications. Many doctors were in search of a cure rather than a treatment, but the cause of schizophrenia remained a mystery, and many accepted that drugs were the only way to help patients for the time being.
Before chlorpromazine was introduced, more than 70% of people with schizophrenia needed continual supervision. They were confined to hospitals or asylums. With the use of antipsychotics, only about 5% required lengthy hospitalization.
For the first time in history, there was hope for patients with schizophrenia. The disorder no longer felt like a life sentence, and instead, a patient could experience some normalcy.
Since Dr. Emil Kraepelin's identification of the disorder back in 1887, our understanding of schizophrenia has come a long way, but its cause still remains a mystery.
And this unknown has caused an unconscious public fear surrounding the disorder, one that's nurtured a social stigma, which has kept people from receiving the help they need.
Today, hundreds of thousands live on the streets. Many of them have an untreated mental health condition, but they're unable to get proper medical care. Others get arrested intentionally, hoping to stay in jail so they can have access to their mental health programs. The treatments for mental health conditions may have evolved, but for many, the lack of access is a devastating black hole, one that offers no easy way out. Thanks for listening to Medical Mysteries. Next week, we'll look at the socioeconomic issues that have affected mental health in America and overseas, and how they've complicated the mysteries in mental health conditions.
You can find all episodes of Medical Mysteries and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals like Medical Mysteries for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Medical Mysteries on Spotify, just open the app and type Medical Mysteries in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
We'll see you next time.
Medical Mysteries was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. It is executive produced by Max Cutler. Sound design by Dick Schroeder, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Travis Clark. This episode of Medical Mysteries was written by Lori Gottlieb, with writing assistance by Maggie Admire, and stars Molly Brandenburg and Richard Rossner.